On the show today, Professor David Kirk, here to talk about his work related to critical pedagogies of effect in physical education and the need to think more deeply and differently about the future of our discipline.
Andy Vasily.
When reflecting back on early life, David Kirk fondly recalls early days growing up in Scotland, but vividly remembers his parents packing up their belongings and moving to the other side of the world to settle down in Brisbane, Australia. During this time, David developed a strong openness to new experiences that would go on to serve him well in the years to follow. After living for a while in Australia, David and his family moved back to Scotland, and it wasn't until high school that he really began to fall in love with physical activity, sport, and movement. In particular, David excelled in track and field, and completely devoted himself to the sport and the elite training needed to become one of the best in the country. Through his athletic pursuits, David developed many strengths on the track, but off the track, he learned the importance of time management, organization, dedication and commitment, as well as resilience and perseverance. These early experiences in sport led David to becoming a physical education teacher, but sparked within him a desire to learn more deeply about his profession, and ultimately led him on the path of becoming an educational researcher with teaching and research interests in educational innovation, curriculum history, and sport pedagogy. David is the founding editor of the peer-reviewed journal Physical Education and Sport Pedagogy and the editor of the Routledge Studies in Physical Education and Youth Sport. David is currently professor of education and the former head of the School of Education at the University of Strathclyde. In this episode, David shares his deep insight related to critical pedagogies of effect, and he also gives us a glimpse into two of his latest books. The first one, Precarity, Critical Pedagogy in Physical Education, and Models-Based Practice in Physical Education, that was co-authored with Dr. Ash Casey. In this episode, David will challenge listeners from the field of PE to think differently about how we might approach the future of our discipline in order to address the social and economic challenges that shape young people's health, happiness, and life chances. It was a pleasure to interview David, and I highly encourage you to connect with him and learn more about his work. Let's jump into the discussion with David talking about early days in his life.
I was born in Scotland, in the west of Scotland, in a place called Motherwell, which had once been part of the Lanarkshire coal fields. And then when the mining industry ran down, it became a big steel town. And that's important because it's a very industrial setting and very working class sort of community. But I was only there until I was, I've had a nomadic early childhood up until about the age of 10. Because when I was six, my mother and father decided to take the family to Australia, to Brisbane. And we lived there for about just over 3 years. I think they must have got homesick because I loved it there. It was absolutely wonderful. But they decided to take us back to Scotland. So I'd had a lot of moving around in those first 9 or 10 years. But by the time we got back to Scotland, we became a bit more settled, and we went to live in a place called Cumbernauld, which is a new town, which some of your listeners might be familiar with that concept. basically Cumbernauld is in the Glasgow, the greater Glasgow conurbation. And Glasgow at that time was looking for places to rehouse its citizens. There had been a lot of old slums, and of course the Second World War had demolished a lot of the properties. And so we had a thing called the Glasgow Overspill. And many of those people from the east side and the south side of Glasgow, the real Glaswegians, the ones that when you listen to them, you probably wouldn't understand what they're saying, so broad is their dialect. They moved out to places like Cumbernauld. So from the age of about 10, I was really a sort of surrogate Glaswegian growing up with kids who came from that part of Scotland. Up until then, sport played absolutely no part of my life. We were well cared for kids, but my parents, we lived paycheck to paycheck. And there was no opportunity for kids from my background to play sport in any way, apart from in the public playing fields with your friends, with jackets on the ground for goalposts. Mm-hmm. And that would be it. But that changed significantly when I went to high school, which was about age 12. And in Scotland at that time, we had moved to a comprehensive system, not a selective system. So we had kids of all abilities and so on coming into high school. And that changed my life, Andy, you know. So all of a sudden, this whole world opened up that I had no access to. There was all these different activities that became available. I couldn't remember doing physical education in primary school. And all of a sudden, I had three periods of physical education every week. And of course, I joined as many teams as I could. So I played, I had no idea what rugby was. People from my background didn't play rugby at that time. But I was joined the rugby team, basketball team. I was the track and field champion in my year, that year. And then from there, I joined, I got serious about track. I started as a long jumper and a sprinter, but then moved to 400, 800. Always think it's something of a masochist, doing those events. But that's where I ended up. And between the ages of about 13 to 17, I was training 5-6 days a week at a fairly decent level, just sort of sub-international for school boys, as it was. So that was hugely influential for me. I mean, just that was the time in my life when all of a sudden physical activity, physical education, sport became this the main thing in life. But I didn't do too well in my crucial exams in my fourth year at high school because I was doing so much running. Mm-hmm. I was told I had to cut back, so I could get through the next set of exams, which were matriculation examinations. They took you into higher education. And I guess at that point, around about 17, I stepped back from that kind of intensive level of sport and never returned to it at any point in my life. After that, I was a recreational dabbler in various things, a lifelong runner until very recently, until my joints have protested too much and said, no, you're not doing that anymore. That really would have been the key time for me, would have been high school and having those opportunities.
Yeah. So when I hear your story, David, it's especially the nomadic living, I think of my own children and, I am eternally grateful. I would never change a thing. Like, I grew up in Canada. I went to university in Canada. It's kind of small city, small town Canada. Never in a million years did I ever think I would leave my city. And I had played American football. It became a passion, American football and golf. And I really looked forward to, after university, either joining the police force, becoming a firefighter or a teacher. In particular, police officer or teacher. So I never imagined I would ever leave. And then I had met my girlfriend, now wife, in university. And then she was open to the world and had traveled and spent time in France. And she was like, I'm going to Japan after university. And then I was like, okay, I guess I'll go to Japan. And then that opened up the whole world to us. And we have not gone back since. And so I've worked at different international schools around the world, five different countries, and I have learned so much about the world. And my boys are considered third culture kids. So they have just, even though they love Canada, they've never lived there. When I think of your story, I think of essentially you being kind of like a third culture kid, like, you know, being born in Scotland, but then moving to Australia. And what I wonder about in your experience is that openness to experience, you know, and you say that sport didn't play an active role in your life, but then in high school, suddenly you were exposed to it. I wonder about the strengths that you developed from your travel experience and learning about the world, and the strengths that you had developed that went on to really serve you well as an athlete, but also in the work that you do. And do you see a connection with that experience in Australia and that openness to culture and travel? Do you see a connection there with the strengths that you developed early on and the athlete that you became, and then ultimately the academic you became?
I think so. And you may not be surprised to learn that I ended up back in Australia for almost 16 years. But I'll tell you more about that. The direct answer to your question, I think that very intensive period of training and competing in track, I learned, and I remember reflecting, you know, a few years after, just a level of self-discipline, time management, just being organized, you know, just being able to fit things in and so on. I think that's been, and that stayed with me all my life, absolutely, crucially. You could not do 6 days training a week, sometimes two sessions a day, a gym session and a run. We at one point were running 80 miles a week with two track sessions and two gym sessions. Yeah. As a 16-year-old, you know. So to do that and have a girlfriend and do your school stuff and all the rest of it was really, really quite demanding. And in fact, it's also left me with an enormous admiration for anybody who makes it to an elite level, particularly in amateur sports, where there's not an awful lot of financial support. I mean, the people who do that really deserve the accolades that they get. So that was crucial. But I think your point about being open to about other things. I left Scotland in 1982 and didn't come back again until 2014 to live. Of course, my family was here, we visited, but I went to Loughborough to do a PhD. I had been a physical education teacher, gone to Jordan Hill, Scottish School of Physical Education, which no longer exists, but was quite an elite college at the time, inspired by my PE teachers. These were the guys who really, you know, I looked up to and thought were, and they were wonderful, wonderful teachers. For a kid like me, they were perfect, and that's what took me into physical education in the first place. But before long, you know, I was on the plane, 1984. My wife, I told her we'd go for 5 years. We stayed for much longer. Our three kids were born there, and it was only family issues and tragedies that brought us back again to the UK. But we came back to Loughborough, so I kind of did a kind of full circle journey thing. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, that for the first part of my career too as an academic, so I was at the University of Queensland for 5 years, 6 years. Then I went to Deakin for another 6 years, then back to Queensland. So that first half of my career as an academic, a scholar, I saw the world mainly through an Australian perspective, an Antipodean, you know, looking up from underneath, down under. And of course, to do anything, you really, and Australians were really open to traveling, you know. You had to travel long haul to get anywhere, because everywhere it was so far away. And that was really very formative for me too, that whole notion. There was an openness about Australians and about Australian culture, at least in my experience at that time, that I couldn't see in the UK. I couldn't see in Scotland, which I still consider to be quite parochial, in a professional context, and its politics too, to a large extent. Mm-hmm. So that was significant for me too. And when I started going to the United States to big conferences to back to Britain, to Canada and other places, people were very surprised when I opened my mouth because they were expecting me to sound like Tim Fletcher. They expected me to sound like my Australian-born colleagues, you know. And even though I did develop a slight accent, it was still fairly Scottish. And that was an interesting experience to start with.
Yeah. And when you think about that, so again, your kids, going back to my kids being third culture kids, they've learned so much, you know, like they just see the world, I believe, so differently. And when we go back to Canada and they hang out with their cousins and who they adore, and then friends of ours who have kids, they always say there's just kind of a different feel to the, maybe the openness to ideas that kids in Canada have who have never left Canada, you know? So having experiences and having friends from all over the world, you know, I'm sure that your children have also felt that, in their experience living in Australia and then moving back and just being very worldly in their views and understanding about the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has a kind of quite a fundamental influence on who they think they are, you know? And they have an enormous affection for Scotland, though they've never lived here, but they visited a lot. And a big issue about living so far away from where your family is, of course, is that the kids miss out. They don't know their cousins. They don't know their grandparents, their aunts and uncles. And that was something that when we did come back, we made a big effort to make sure that we were connected to family. And that has made just such a difference, you know? Because the kids have a sense of an anchor as well as an openness to the world places beyond where they live.
Yeah, for sure. So like getting into your work and getting more specific now, can you just share with the listeners, how would you describe the work that you do now and why it means so much to you? I'm sure your career over the years has meant a lot to you, but just talk about present day work. And anything you want to say about that, just to set the frame for the discussion to follow.
Well, when we came back from Australia, it was 1998, and we spent 16 years in England, a fair amount of time at Loughborough University. So coming back to Scotland was really quite an interesting experience, really quite interesting, because even though I've been away for such a long time, I don't think you lose a sense of your roots, of who you are, where you're from. I came back as the head of the School of Education at the University of Strathclyde, which was, in fact, what was left of Jordan Hill College, where I had gone as an undergraduate student. So there was that connection too. Mm-hmm. And I did my 3-year spell as head of school, which was very interesting. Then I had a very nice sabbatical where I was able to do a lot of traveling and wrote a book on precarity, which is I'll talk a little bit about, because that's what I've been working on most recently, and what I call pedagogies of affect. But since this sabbatical, I've come back as a kind of deputy head with a responsibility for research. I'd been a dean at Leeds Metropolitan University in England. I've been a head of department acting at University of Queensland. So I'd done some of that leadership stuff before. But I think you also get to a point in your career where you feel, I'm not interested in being a vice chancellor, although I probably have a track record that would put me in a position to be competitive for that. That is a particular kind of job that I know I don't have the interest in or the skills to do. And that's an important thing, you know, you realize about yourself. When you've been on this promotion thing, you know, becoming a senior lecturer, becoming a professor, you know, becoming a head of school, a dean and so on, you've got this sort of idea that you've got to keep going. And I do think it's actually quite liberating to be able to say, hey, you know, where I am at the moment is really where I want to be. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I need to be somewhere else. So that's been really, really liberating, as I say, and most recently, in a scholarly sense, I've been doing some really, really interesting things with some wonderfully talented doctoral students and some fantastic colleagues. You mentioned Ash Casey. And we've just finished writing a book. I published a book on model space practice in physical education. During the sabbatical, I had the opportunity to travel to South America. I've been to Brazil maybe 5 or 6 times now. I got a chance to go to Colombia, which was wonderful. I managed to get to New Zealand. I was all over the place, really. I was traveling, great connections in Norway and Sweden, doing projects there. And I was working on this book on precarity, and really surprised to find that few people understood what precarity is and why it should be important to physical education. But as soon as you explain the concept to people, they say, ah, okay, yes, we get it. And just for the sake of your listeners and for those who haven't come across it, so precarity is a concept that explains the relationship between unstable, uncertain work in particular, although that can be generalized into life more generally, but unstable work, the gig economy, the 0 hours contract, the short-term contracts, the periods of unemployment, the relationship between that and health and well-being.
Okay.
And in particular, mental health. And effectively, what precarity does, what that uncertainty and instability in life does is it makes people ill. It makes people ill. And we've all had a taste of this now, worldwide with the pandemic. And particularly in those early months where we had no idea when things would open up again. We had no weekend plan. We couldn't say, well, I'm going to take a vacation on such and such a time, you know, and so you can generalize this notion of precarity. It aligns very easily with words like precarious. And interestingly, you know, there's words in French, precarité, and Spanish, precariedad, that, you know, have got exact equivalents to English. So it's interesting, at least for the Latin-based languages, it's got quite a wide understanding. So I was interested to say, okay, in conditions of precarity, and this precarity has come on the back of a decade of austerity in the UK, where we had a government that was intent on running us down in terms of public services, the National Health Service, and so on, which ironically, you know, put us in such a vulnerable position when it came to COVID. And people ask the question, why did Britain perform so badly? Why so many people die? Well, it was no wonder our public services had been run into the ground. So for me, the question was, and I was writing the book, and it was published actually before the pandemic started, which was kind of
good timing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Good timing. Very interesting. what was I saying there?
Did you have an inquiry question that kind of led that the book?
Yes, I did. I did. And the question was this: how does physical education respond in conditions of precarity?
Okay.
What can we do as physical educators in this situation where it's not just workers who get sick, it's their kids who get sick? And we have a situation in Britain, I imagine it's fairly worldwide, of a rising prevalence of mental health issues for children and adolescents. I mean, really, this is an emerging crisis.
Yeah.
Now, if you listen to Mackenzie and Salas and Pate and those guys who do the fitness stuff, the MVPA, they talk about obesity and cardiovascular disease. These are serious issues. But MVPA in a physical education lesson does not address the anger, the anxiety, the alienation, the anomie that people experiencing precarity are living. And so my question was to say, what would be a response, an adequate response on the part of physical education? And I came up with this idea of pedagogies of affect. So I guess we've always worked in the affective domain in physical education, but, you know, so we've always talked about, you know, character building, but more recently, motivation, resilience, perseverance, fun, enjoyment, but always is hoped for byproducts of the work on developing physical competences and so on, rather than as an intended learning aspiration. So pedagogies of effect shift the focus in physical education to the affective domain.
Right.
So what we're actually teaching for is kids to get experiences of becoming motivated, mm-hmm. learning how you might be resilient in the face of challenges and hardship, how you persevere with particular issues, how you bounce back ability, which are, you know, is Don Hellison, whose name I'm sure you're yeah. familiar with, recognized this stuff all those years ago, working in the ghettos in Portland and Oregon and then in Chicago, that sport and physical activity are fantastic media for helping young people develop those life skills, I guess. So in the Precarity book, it's called Precarity, Critical Pedagogy and Physical Education. I was interested to try and identify where we were already doing this kind of work and identified Hellison's teaching personal social responsibility and the positive youth development work that's been inspired by that. Some versions of Daryl Seedentop's sport education, like Kathy Ennis's Sport for Peace and Pete Hastie's Empowering Sport. Mm-hmm. And then Kim Oliver's work around activist approaches to working with adolescent girls. And more recently, we've taken that work, Kim and I, to the favelas of Brazil. We worked with Carla Luguetti to develop an approach for working with socially vulnerable youth in that context in Santos in Brazil. Interestingly, those scholars, particularly Hellison and Oliver, have in the course of their careers been marginalized completely in the academy, I think, in physical education. They've been working, are we doing this kind of work? It doesn't generate a lot of high-powered publications. Mm-hmm. Hellison was constantly defending the fact that he didn't have data. You know, he didn't have big grants. I think it's some of the most important work that's been done since the 1970s, 80s for Hellison and Seedentop's work. I think sport education Seedentop was a straight down the line behaviorist, but he did develop a great model, yeah. I think, in terms of, you know, inspiring kids. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it work in primary schools. My wife led a fantastic project in a school she worked in Loughborough for children who were age 10, 11. It's a brilliant time to use sport education. So that's what I've been working on recently, Andy. And I've had a couple of PhD students now, a young guy from Japan called Eishin Teraoka, who did a great study of physical education teachers in Scottish schools who were using pedagogies of effect without any prompting, without any training. These people were recognizing the need amongst their kids and were adapting physical education.
Were they, when you say that they were using it, they had made a conscious decision to focus on these areas without knowing the pedagogies of effect research?
Precisely.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
they just felt in their heart that was the best approach to take.
In a sense, these physical education teachers have been ahead of the curve, mm-hmm. in terms of where we've been in the academy, at least in terms of the bulk of the work. I've had another PhD student, Carol Lam, who's a colleague at Strathclyde now, a very experienced teacher. And she's been working with Oliver's activist approach in Glasgow schools. So this is what we've been doing so Cara has done an intervention with teachers to teach them how to use an activist approach. Teraoka went out to see what our teachers doing. This was a purposive sample. So we went looking for these folks. You know, these are people in the Scottish context. We have in our curriculum for excellence, the national curriculum in physical education, we have four what were called significant aspects of learning: physical fitness, physical competencies, cognitive development, and what is called personal qualities. And personal qualities are all about the affective domain. So the teachers already had this as their, if you like, policy. And some teachers had put their hand up and said, personal qualities, that's where we really need to focus. And not surprisingly, you know, and I think this is one of the things that we really need to be much better at in terms of research and policy making. It's the kids who come from the multiply disadvantaged communities where this need is greater, you know. And my own personal view is if we've got limited resources available to us, we should be directing it in quite a targeted way towards those places that need the resource. I've always been troubled by what Michael Gard called, you know, he says that if we read some of the advocates for physical education as public health, combating obesity and so on, then everybody everywhere is at risk of being obese. Well, actually, no, that is not true. Factually not correct. Some people are at a much higher risk of becoming obese than others. And it's not people who are affluent, you know? So I think that even in our, you know, we need that level of intellectual rigor, precision, and honesty about what we think we're doing with the resource we've got available to us.
Yeah. And you know what I find fascinating about that, when I take in everything you just said, it goes back to this idea, again, a lot of the work that I've done, and I really believe strongly in my role as a physical educator, is to create the conditions to intrinsically motivate my learners to be engaged in their learning in a way that is, obviously they have their own entry point to learning into the units that we're doing, but then to inspire them to take action when they're not in PE. So after school and on yep. weekends. And that's why I connected so deeply with this meaningful PE framework and the five features, which are, you know, joy and delight, challenge, personal relevance, social interaction, and motor competence. So in yep. particular, the work that I did with Dr. Tim Fletcher was to look at, to prioritize challenge. And I felt that if I prioritize that feature of challenge, meaning that to help every student understand what that just right challenge for them is in a unit, which means I need to greatly differentiate the learning experiences, allow for an exploration of what's possible, and then kind of help to navigate and facilitate them towards finding that just right challenge, that they will develop intrinsic motivation to, and then motor competence kind of takes care of itself. So I've done this, I've really worked on this approach for a number of years. And when I hear you speak, I really feel some of that coming alive and connecting with what you're describing. So if you could go in and design your own PE program, what are the first things that you would do, or how would you train teachers to be able to plant those seeds for all kids to flourish? Like, how would you want them to structure the program, and what are the first things that you would want them to focus on?
On the way to answering that question, Andy, a couple of caveats, I guess, in terms of what I was saying.
Yeah.
The first one is, I don't think there's only one best way to do physical yeah. education.
For sure.
I'm sure you're aware of Dr. Hal Lawson and his significant contribution to physical education. And he's always challenging me on this point. You know, mm-hmm. there's no one best way to do right. this. And that's fundamentally important. The other thing is that when you talk about, so pedagogies of effect are selected because they're the right thing to use in a particular set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. That's an important thing to say.
So knowing your context, knowing your context as an educator.
Absolutely. Knowing yeah. your context. I think the just right challenge actually captures that quite nicely for me, that knowing that this is right for this mm-hmm. Person in these circumstances. I guess the other thing to clarify is that even if you go back to, so with pedagogies of effect, it doesn't mean to say you're ignoring other stuff mm-hmm. that physical education does. If you go back to Hellison's early work, the Beyond Bats and Balls and so on, that he wrote in the 70s, and one of the things he says is that don't forget for a second that it's not important for those kids you're working with to become better at what they're doing. Whether it's having a higher rate of accuracy, a higher percentage with the basketball shots, or whether it's building muscle with their fitness work, or physical competence and excellence, striving for that are key, Absolutely important. Don't forget that. But it's not the central focus of what you're doing. But it is there. I always like to think about foregrounding and backgrounding, you know. So rather than physical competence, let's say, dropping off a cliff and disappearing, it's there. It's connected to the affective domain, but it's in behind it. It's just in behind. We can still see it. It's a wee bit less focused. It's a bit blurry. And then we've got other programs. And when we talk about models-based practice, which is coming around to answering your question, and we shift that focus and we say, okay, we're going to concentrate on your ability to become a good performer in games. We're going to use a games-based, maybe TGFU or something like that, kind of teach games for understanding, something like tactical games model, where the focus is on your performance as a games player and developing your tactical awareness and as well as your skill in appropriate context. So I guess the first thing to say about what would be appropriate for physical education, I had a paper that came out, I think around about 2005-06, where I made an argument that we were putting most of our resources in the wrong place in physical education in public schools. So my experience was I met this stuff when I was 12 years old. Arguably, that's way too late to be getting the first professional instruction in the physical domain when you're 12. I was lucky, you know, I was in good enough position to be able to take advantage of that. But there are a lot of kids by then who'd experienced, let's say, motor development delay as younger children, who are the kids who constantly trip over their feet, who run away from the ball when it's thrown to them. So I think that the big revolution for physical education, and I know that this varies in different constituencies, different jurisdictions for education, but certainly in my experience in Britain and also in Australia and many other countries in Europe, the main resource for physical education is in the secondary school. It's where the specialist teachers are. It's where the specialist facilities are. We need it in the primary schools. We need it much, much earlier. And I think that that in itself would cause a revolution in the way that a lot of physical education is taught. Because the big shift for me in the course of my career was moving from a position where I was taught that I was the most important component in the pedagogical relationship. It was about me as the teacher. It was my performance as a teacher that was key. And what I've come to understand is that actually not that at all. It's about the kids. And that may sound a kind of simple thing to say, but yeah. It took me a number of years to actually get beyond myself and get beyond my training to start to understand that, okay, and it's a very powerful process of socializing young teachers in schools. You know, to be judged to be a good teacher is the person who can keep these kids under control, who can discipline them, who can get them to do what you want them to do. But they're not learning
controlling that much.
Exactly. And submission, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, which is so. I think when you start to work with younger kids, you can't get away with that kind of pedagogy. You know, you have to be more student-centered to be able to run effective programs. So that'd be one thing I would say. A second thing I think is this whole concept of models-based practice that a number of people have been developing, but Ash and I have just, and we pay our dues to people like Michael Metzler and in his model-based instruction. We pay our dues to Anne Jewett and Linda Bain and Kathy Ennis with their curriculum models approach, and others besides Debbie Tannehill and Jackie Lund and others who've done work in this whole models area. But this notion of models-based practice and pedagogical models, we think is a way to radically shift the focus of physical education teaching. And physical education programs. If I could bore your listeners for just a second longer. So the analyses that I've done historically of physical education suggests that schools took their current form in places like Britain, Canada, Australia, the States, and so on, In the industrial age, in the last half of the 19th century, to mention Hal Lawson again, he talks about the industrial age school. And there's two fundamental coordinates around which that kind of school is organized, space and time. Space in terms of designated classrooms or science labs or playing fields or gymnasia, and time in terms of the timetable. And nowhere do you see this more orchestrated, if you like, as in the secondary school, where the bell rings or whatever, the buzzer goes, and the kids 50 minutes of this, and then they move 50 minutes of that, and so on. Now, from a physical education point of view, and certainly in Britain, certainly after the Second World War, British physical educators lobbied long and hard to be recognised as a subject in the curriculum, just like any other. So, in other words, they argued for their place in the 50-minute period of instruction. The only sane response to that kind of structure in schools is the multi-activity, sports technique-based physical education program, where you do six lessons on basketball, six lessons on soccer, six lessons in gymnastics. What do you teach in the space of time that you've got? Well, you've got 30 kids, mixed motivations and mixed ability, which, by the way, has got worse since I entered physical education, because community-based sport is now so much more widespread than it was when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. The kids come with even a wider range of abilities than they ever did when I was teaching in the late 70s and early 80s. So physical educators are faced with this group of 30 kids coming. They're coming from the physics lesson, which is on the other side of the school. It takes them 5 minutes at least to get to the physical education department. 45 minutes. It takes them 5 minutes to get changed. 40 minutes. It takes them 5 minutes to get to either the playing field or into the gym and set up the equipment. 35 minutes. Reverse the process on the other side. What can you do with 30 kids, mixed ability, mixed motivation, in 20 minutes? You teach them some sport techniques. How to bounce a basketball, different passes. How to play with the hockey ball. Can we play a game, Miss Sir? Maybe that is a treat at the end of the six lesson unit, where the kids haven't developed any competencies that they didn't have before they came in. As I say, that's the only sane response to that kind of structure of time and space in the secondary school. That is what we've got to blow up. We need to put dynamite underneath that structure and blow it up. We need to claim for ourselves an exceptionalism, which is always a very, very dangerous thing to do. But we need to say we cannot do effective physical education within that structure. Here's what we can do, and it's incredibly limited. Now, here's the thing. We run enormous risks in doing this. In a sense, the lack of productive outcomes for kids through physical education programs in public schools is actually the elephant in the room for us. We can never go public and talk about our inability to provide evidence of what kids have gained from physical education. Sure, we can provide anecdotes, you know, any number of them. But where's the solid evidence that our kids are more skillful, more competent, more motivated, have higher levels of perseverance, have better health, have dispositions to become lifelong participants? Where's the evidence for any of the things that we normally claim for physical education? And it's not there. In the precarity book, I did a kind of rough estimate. It's not easy to do because of the way that funding is dispersed for physical education in Scotland, and I would imagine in many other jurisdictions too. But in terms of even just thinking about how much we spend on teachers' salaries on an annual basis in Scotland, I estimated that we're spending something like £80 million a year. I don't know what the translation is into dollars, euros, and Saudi Arabian currency, but it's a lot of money. Yeah. For £80 million a year, and that doesn't take account of the capital costs of building facilities. It doesn't take account of the cost of preparing teachers in universities. £80 million a year. What do we get for that? So we've got to be very careful how we do this, because we could just as easily have a government turn around and say, well, we don't need your specialist teachers anymore because they're not doing the job that we need them to do. We're much better going with that, I don't know, sports coaches who are much cheaper to employ, or physical activity instructors, you know, who have got lower levels of training and so on. So I think there's arguments we need to be making for models-based practice, because models-based practice can't be done in 3 50-minute periods a week. It can't be done even to run a sport education season. You know, so some of your listeners will be very familiar with, many may have tried this themselves. Pretty hard to have a season of, say, 12 lessons, you know, because that's what you need. You need 12 lessons at least to have a decent season. Hard to do it within the multi-activity framework. So how do you do that? How do you argue for that? How do you claim that exceptionalism? How do you get head teachers and local authorities and district supervisors and so on to come on board with you and start to see what might be possible through this approach? So it's a complex kind of answer, Andy, to your question. I mean, we don't even need to get started on teacher education, because there's a whole new sort of level of complexity in terms of how we do that these days. But yeah, that would be, for me, that's what's preoccupying me at this moment in time, is how we take an agenda forward around those kind of aspirations.
So what I want to ask you is, in returning back to teaching, so I told you before I started the podcast with you, is that, you know, I've been an instructional coach for the last number of years, so I haven't been in the classroom teaching regularly. However, I'm alongside teachers all the time. And I'm lucky that some teachers are really open to me co-teaching with them. And I've done that several times in the PE program here at the school in Saudi Arabia. But when you're working alongside teachers, it's really important in my role as an instructional coach to help support them in their professional inquiry. So we have a collaborative inquiry type approach here, where the teachers develop an inquiry question that they're interested in pursuing and knowing more about. Then as an instructional coach, I'm there to help guide them along and get them to consider what data they may collect that will help them help to inform their professional inquiry. So as a teacher this year, I thought it was critically important that I have my own teacher inquiry so that I can go through this process, because I've coached teachers through the process, but now I'm teaching. So I really felt I needed my own professional inquiry. So part of that is student voice, and really collecting student voice and really digging into the students' experiences and what is it that they're truly feeling about their experiences in PE. So this goes full circle back to what you just described. And I want to ask you the role of student voice in this process, and any kind of insight you have around the importance of collecting student voice and what that might look like. For me, it was having somebody come in and interview. They interviewed randomly across all of my classes, a number of students, 3 simple questions. The one thing that was important for me is that the kids understood that they had choice, right? Mm-hmm. And that goes with the Just Right Challenge and finding their entry point. It was important to me that they knew that I was there to help them when they needed help. And it was important to me that they could understand the progress that they made. So this was in a 9-week cycling unit. We thought cycling was perfect in our context for COVID. Social distancing, we're outdoors. And I felt that I had delivered this unit in a strong way, but I couldn't base that on a hunch. So the student voice really surprised me. I was like, man, I've been all about choice from the beginning. And then it came back saying that a number of kids felt that they had some choice in the unit. And then in terms of me helping them, a number of kids were that I helped them some of the time and very little. So, and it was so important for me to for them to understand that I wanted them to know that I was there. So now I had to really look at that data, with an open mind and say, what is this telling me? And how can this inform the next steps in my own pedagogy and the teaching that I'm going to put into action? So I've chosen to be really explicit in my language about choice, because I can't assume that they understand that choice exists. I have to be really explicit in that. Sure. And then secondly, my coach who collected the data said, you know, like, you're taking this maybe a little bit hard. Like, the kids are saying that you're not helping them, but you create the conditions for kids to find their own entry points. So they might not need you as much in this situation. Then I can be more of a facilitator. So that's one way to look at it. But I am not going to assume that that's the way, even though that's the way I want to look at it. So I have put specific steps into action in this current unit that I'm doing. And then he'll come back and collect more student voice to know if I'm on the right track. So this goes back to the power of student voice. So can you speak about any insight you have about student voice and what teachers need to consider in their practice when it comes to it?
I think it's a great example you've just given. And that holding that mirror up to yourself is a really brave thing to do, to get the kids to tell you, you know, because you can't make assumptions that there's a one-way process between, well, I taught them this, or I told them this, or I set this up, therefore they must have got it the same. No, not at all. Because as you say, so the thing that comes to mind immediately is what Kim Oliver's work with the adolescent girls through the activist approach. And I learned so much from Kim and working with her. Kim always says you start where the kids are. You start where the kids are, not collectively necessarily, although individualization, differentiation of tasks is really important. But what she does in her approach is she has two phases for activist work. The first one is she calls building the foundation. And it involves bringing her class out of the, well, they might stay in the gym, they might sit on the gym floor, but they don't do any physical activity for a couple of lessons, because they go through a number of tasks about their experiences that relate to their experiences of physical education. And they get a chance to say these things, write these things for the teacher. What they come up with eventually through this process is a unit of work, a program that runs for the semester, where they are given explicit opportunities to make choices collectively. So Kim talks about the co-construction of physical education. So one of the things that, because adolescent girls in particular have been a target for her, and we know that we hear a lot about adolescent girls dropping out, not being interested, and so on. So one of the things that works really well with a lot of these classes is that they draw up a contract collectively about how they're going to work in their physical education lessons. And this is discussed, and it's negotiated with the teacher and the pupils and so on. And eventually, in the study that Carol Lamb has done, the teachers put the contract on a whiteboard in the gym. And it's things like, we agree that we will always try our best in a lesson, regardless of the activity. We will always respect each other in relation to the work that we're doing, and so on and so forth. Then what they do in the building the foundation is that they do a kind of sampler kind of series of classes. And it's to break away from the more traditional activities that the girls have had for a couple of years and have become, in a sense, they either know they're good at this or not, you know. So, and they have a say in what these might be. So one week it might be, I'm trying to think of trampolining. The next week it might be something to do with a kind of dance-based form of exercise, and so on and so forth. And so they get this chance to sample things that they wouldn't typically get to do in a physical education program.
So when you say sample, explore.
Explore.
Okay.
Yeah. So each week it's a different class. It's planned.
Yeah.
The program's planned. The kids have got an explicit say. Now, they may not always be doing something that they chose.
Right.
But part of the contract is that they will get stuff that they chose. And when they're not doing stuff that they haven't chosen, they agree they're going to try hard in that class. So this is a work in progress that goes on for the semester. And then the next part is the activist work moves into a thematic unit where they take a theme that, again, the kids have got an input to what that theme might be, and then to, well, how do we approach this theme? It might be something pretty simple, like how can I stay in best shape? What kind of things can I be doing? And so some programs might say, what can I do in school? What can I do at home? And what can I do when I meet my friends?
Awesome.
And this is the program. And Kim talks about inquiry-based education centered in action. So the kids themselves are task themselves with generating their own data about their experiences. And that can take any number of different forms too. I mean, all of this can be customized to suit your circumstances, your kids, their particular challenges, their particular circumstances.
So David, I just have a quick question there, clarification question. So once they go into that second semester and it's these activist themes, did you say?
It's a thematic unit. Yeah.
So then is it, for example, focused on ball games? Like, is there a general theme, or you just said like it might be getting in the best shape or like staying in shape or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So they can then take that in directions that they want with certain parameters.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. That latter thing is exactly right. Yeah. You should get Kim to come talk to you about this
because
she can, she's just so good at this.
Can you spell her last name? Is it
Oliver?
Oliver. Oliver.
Okay. O-L-I-V-E-R. Yeah, my Scottish accent.
So. Okay. I will definitely speak to her after this.
She's based at New Mexico State University. And,
okay. Awesome.
You know, she's done this groundbreaking work since, I would say, the late 90s.
Right.
And hasn't got the recognition she deserves, in my view, because it really is special stuff. So that's a good, really good example of the explicit co-construction of physical education, where there are genuine choices for the pupils at a number of different levels, all the way from the curriculum program level to within lessons, differentiation of, I'm not going to work on this task, I'm going to work at that level in this task. Self-determination in the sense that you do determine how you're going to work and what you're going to do. But accountability too. And this is the thing that I think used to bug Hillison, and I know that bugs Oliver too, is it's almost like if you give students choices, then it's a free-for-all, you know? It's not a free-for-all. It's very carefully structured. There's accountability. There's responsibility. And in fact, that's what kids are learning as much as anything.
Well, that's what Dr. Richard Ryan from Self-Determination Theory was on my podcast a few months ago. And that's the first thing he said. He said that the danger is everybody thinks that it's a free-for-all, but it's not. You know, that would be chaos. We're not promoting chaos. There are parameters in place. There are constraints. You know, and that's the important thing to understand. It's not a free for all, you know? So I just wanted to add that in.
No, absolutely. I think that for teachers, I think that part of the deal here is recognizing that you can only do so much of this work in a school, because schools are particular kinds of institutions that have got particular ways of operating. Carol Lam and I, we've put together a practitioner research hub, just for people in this part of Scotland. I have a young teacher who teaches in a school I can see from my study window here in the local town, who's been very, very proactive in this context. And we talk a lot about how you extend the program into the after-school environment.
Yeah.
And we've got some really nice research that's been happening in the last decade around before school, after school clubs. And what that does is that it starts to stretch the notion then of the school as an institution. It's not just a place you go to work in classrooms under teacher direction, but this is a place that you can go and actually steer your own path through. You can follow your own track, if you like, if the school is set up in a way that allows you to do that kind of thing. And, you know, when you think about it, it just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
I mean, who likes to be ordered around? Who likes to be, you know, told they have to do things they don't want to do, they don't like doing, they're no good at? But that's what we do in a lot of physical education practice. because of the context in which we work. You know, teachers are tasked with something that's it's almost impossible to do well. And yet many, many teachers give kids positive experiences despite that context. But we could do so much better. We could do so much more. And particularly coming back around to this whole thing about precarity, about austerity, about pandemics and so on, we need to do so much better and so much more because kids need it. And it's a huge resource that we're putting in place that needs to be used more effectively and efficiently. So here we've got policy, here we've got governments. And joining all these things up is an enormous challenge. It really is.
Yeah.
And I have to say my experience up until now has not been positive in terms of how seriously university scholars are taken by policy people or to some extent even by teachers, you know. I think these divides are still there. People work in their own spheres where they've got their own priorities and they don't necessarily see how... I keep saying to people, you know, outside the university community, we're a publicly funded resource, damn it, you know, users. Users in ways that can make your life easier. And I'm always astonished by people's reluctance to actually embrace that. And then when people do, for example, my young colleague in the school across the road, they all of a sudden they say, oh gosh, like, so this, these whole libraries that you can access all of this research, you know, and you can get beyond the paywalls and you can actually get this stuff out of there for us and you can share it with, you know, that's just one very minor example. I keep talking too about international networks and, you know, knowing people, having colleagues and friends in all parts of the world, as I know you do, I do. And most of the time, those colleagues are delighted if a young teacher writes to them and says, excuse me, doctor, so-and-so, I'm working with David Kirk and I'm interested in this and you're an expert on it. Would you be able to share some of your thoughts on this or that or whatever? I'd say 99 out of 100 of the academics I know are absolutely tickled pink when somebody actually takes an interest in their work.
Yeah, and that's what I found, like, for the last, my teaching really changed when I started to reach out to academics and researchers. I did a lot of work with Dean Dudley. Do you know Dr. Dean Dudley?
Yeah.
So I did a lot of work with Dean early on and then Ash and, like I said, Tim Fletcher. And then this just gets the wheels spinning. And then it flips back to my own practice and thinking about what's possible and giving my permission or giving myself permission to really go with it. And knowing that I have the best of intentions at heart for my learners. And that's when you talk about like that connection with after school, that's what we're trying to build here. It's taken a few years to really get community members involved, but we're trying to create a PE program based on community. So again, like skateboarding and cycling and tennis and golf. And because these things are what is literally outside our doors here. So we just did this 9-week cycling unit and then we decided we were going to continue with cycling, in particular road safety, but we would take the show on the road and start going to some public parks to show kids what's possible at the park. So I've taken my classes this week to the golf course, which is about 800 meters from the school, because we have this amazing foot golf course on the driving range. So I took them there. We rode our bikes there. It takes about 10 minutes. We ride right onto the range. We get the footballs out and then they kick the football around. And a lot of them played foot golf for the first time. And again, getting student voice at the end, they're like, majority of students were like, that was a 4 out of 5 or a 5 out of 5 for them. Then there were a few that were a 1 or a 2 out of 5, but that's because the bike ride to the golf course really tired them out and they were hot and they were tired and dehydrated. It wasn't about the experience. So next year we have an after school club coordinator starting here that's moving from a kindergarten position, who's a wonderful teacher, Jorge Rodriguez. And we're really going to work hard at building in. So whatever unit we're doing in PE, we're building an after school club so the kids can take action. And nice. And then, the, you know, we will begin to, you know, qualitative research, you know, qualitative data, but then we'll have metrics in place to show how many kids are signing up for these clubs. So that's our intention. And that's what we're hoping to achieve in the next couple of years with our program here.
And I think that there's no shortage of creative ideas in our community and physical education. You know, that this is the frustrating thing. We've got so many talented people, so many creative ideas, so many good pedagogical models that we could be using. And yet you go into schools and you see teachers struggling with these same challenges, 30 kids, different motivations, different interests, you know, this short period of time that they've got to work with them. As I say, we've got to blow that up. We've got to actually release the creative energies and talents that we've got in our professional body. And it's there. It's all across the world, it's there.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you. I want to talk about PE Futures. So a friend of mine, Dr. Greg Dreyer, from the UK, I told him that I was going to have a chat with you. And he suggested that I ask you this question because I think it'll really give the listeners some more context to some of your work. So you wrote PE Futures in 2009, correct?
It came out in 2010, yeah.
Yeah. So you predicted three futures. So can you remind the listeners what those futures were and which ones you feel have played out or not played out?
Sure. I'm not sure that prediction was quite what I was doing. More like warning that these are the things that might happen. I often say to students, if I could predict the future, that I wouldn't be standing in front of you here right now. I'd be on my yacht in the Caribbean or doing something as interesting as that. So the one that I thought was most likely in the short to middle term is, I called it more of the same. We keep doing the same old, and it's, I've come to understand it's partly around this obdurate structure that's created around time and space in schools. And we need to blow that up. You know, we need to fragment that. We need to be arguing that this does not work for physical education. And then we need to be accepting of creative solutions. So if we don't see the kids every week for three periods, but we see them once a month for a day or half a day, or I don't know, you know, maybe there's different ways of doing this at different stages in kids' school careers, you know. So more of the same, I thought, was the most likely thing, because these are such powerful forces, and it's a multi-level, multi-dimensional thing. I mentioned already that when young teachers come into physical education in schools, and Tony Rossi and his colleagues at University of Queensland have written a great book based on a study of this. When you move into the staff room in a secondary physical education department and the socialization forces that are operating there, of how you identify yourself as belonging there, having a right to be there, and being a good teacher. And I think it was Dave Brown and John Evans that wrote about generational reproduction amongst physical education teachers. You know, we get the same stuff being passed on because teachers, and the teachers who can't deal with this, they get out. They get out early. The ones who are likely to be more creative, more rebellious, more whatever, they move out. Anyway, more of the same, I thought, was the... The second thing was radical reform. And I guess that we've talked throughout this podcast about what I think and what you think radical reform might look like.
Yeah.
And it is radical in the sense that it does require different structures, even a different location of where the expertise and resources are in physical education, much earlier in the school career for young people. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't mean by that we don't have some forms of physical, like recreation, physical active leisure, you know, opportunities to be active in the secondary school. Yes, we do. But not the stuff we do at the moment. Not the assumption that kids, when they get to year one in secondary, that we're starting from a blank slate. They all know nothing about anything, and they all get taught the same stuff. Here's a basketball. Here's how you do a bounce pass. I mean, really, you know? But that's about where it is in some programs. So radical reform, failing radical reform is a kind of middle to longer term future. The third warning was extinction. And I think the possibility of that is growing all the time, you know. I think just to talk about teacher education for a second, what we've seen in Britain since I had a Korean PhD student, Chang Han Lee, who studied physical education, teacher education in Britain. 2009 he started and he finished 2012-13. In the space of time that he was doing his doctorate, we managed to lose all of our undergraduate teacher education programs in physical education, except for three in the whole country, maybe four. So we went from a situation where we had, I don't know, and back in the day when I was doing my undergraduate, we had hundreds of programs where you did a four-year training to become a teacher, typically with a B.Ed. degree or something like that. That had shrunk by 2012-2013 in Britain to a program at Bedford, where I was based at the time, program at Brighton, a program in Edinburgh, which is now disappearing, and the program at Stirling, I think, although I'm not sure about that one. And what we've shifted to instead is a much less expensive way of preparing teachers, which is a one-year postgraduate certificate or diploma. And the people who come into those programs come from any number of different undergraduate degree programs. You know, it might be sport development, it might be kinesiology, it might be physiotherapy, it might be, who knows what it is. So there's a massive, massive issue there in terms of the teachers that we're putting into schools in the first place. So here's another challenge that we need to be addressing. What kind of teachers would we need if we moved provision to the primary school? What kind of teachers do we need? And then if we're going to run active leisure programs in the secondary school, what kind of facilitators, teachers might we need in that context? So the radical reform thing is a big deal, and the extinction possibility increases year on year, because I think that as resources are always under threat in public education systems, and as they become more pressed, we've seen this in England. England and Scotland have different education systems. People outside Britain might not know this. And what's happened in the last 20 years in England is it's become completely marketized. And that's affected schools. So we've got these academy programs run by trusts that are free from local government control. Universities have lost their control over their programs. Many teachers are trained in schools these days rather than in universities, or they're there on a kind of day release kind of basis. In Scotland, it's a very, very different set of circumstances. But what we've seen in England, where local authorities are still in control and so on, and the marketing thing doesn't exist, what we're seeing in England, and people like Gerard Griggs and others have written about this very nicely, is the outsourcing of physical education to weekend trained sports coaches, people who run their own businesses. Now, it's not to say that is necessarily a bad thing, but the quality control is certainly not there. There's no national standards that people have to reach in order to go into schools to teach. Whereas in Scotland, we have a general teaching council, which you have to be registered with before you're allowed anywhere near a school. So it's happening already in England. Physical education is in serious trouble, as is our schools generally, in my opinion, and universities too. And it needn't be that way. And I'm not claiming that we do things much, much better in Scotland. That's not the issue at all. We've got a different system that operates differently. And I think there's less threat of physical education disappearing in the shorter term in Scotland. But it's under enormous pressure in England. And I'd say the same from what I hear from colleagues in the States, in different parts of the States, that we've got real issues there in terms of even recruiting teachers to certain kinds of schools. And there's always somebody else who's keen to come in into the space that we occupy. Cheryl Hoffman wrote a wonderful satirical essay way back in the 80s, Dreaming the Impossible Dream. And the impossible dream was that professionally provided, publicly funded physical education would disappear and that we'd be privatized. And it was only kids who could afford to pay who would actually get provision in schools. and the other kids wouldn't get anything at all. And of course, he wakes up and realizes that this was a dream, but actually it wasn't, because it's already started happening.
I saw something this week and I was so triggered. And I just, I see it, and I'm just, I sometimes get on social, and I have connected with so many amazing educators on Twitter, you know, like Ash, like Dean Dudley, like Tim Fletcher, so many teachers around the world. And I have grown and learned so much through them and through our dialogue and through sharing our practice and challenging each other to think a little differently. And, you know, I have devoted my life to it. And I agree that there's no one right way to do it. You know, that we have to be inquirers and we have to tinker with our approach, and but we have to know the impact of our approach and then be willing to reflect on it and then change direction when need be, and not hold on to something so tight that it gets in the way of us being critical of our own practice. So I feel I've done a decent job there, but I saw a video that was shared. And it showed, it was posted by Squat University. I don't know if you saw it, but it showed a gym class, a grade 6 gym class in the US. And it was obviously a rich private school. They had a bunch of squat racks. The PE teacher, who I did a little bit of research, was a football coach, American football coach, of course.
Okay.
And then there was another teacher that was filming him. So he's literally squat down there with a whistle all along one side. There's about 10 squat racks. There's 10 boys that are at the squat racks. On the other side, there's 10 girls that are at the squat rack. Then behind them is a line of three waiting their turn. He's blowing the whistle. And at the same time, all 10 boys and all 10 girls go down, squat, come up, and then the ones behind them are kind of like supporting, spotting them. Blows the whistle again. 1, 2, 3, and the kids are all counting in unison. And I saw it, and the quote that somebody put up, the teacher put up who was filming, was, "We're getting them ready." And my response was like, "Ready for what? Like, please help me understand." You know, and I found myself being very judgmental, which I don't like. And I got hammered. I was called stupid. I was told to get educated. I was told I have no idea what I'm talking about. And I was trying to start a dialogue. But then I found myself, I'm being too judgmental. I don't know the context of this school. And, you know, they have everything, obviously. So maybe this is a good thing, but I just felt it was control and compliance. There was no differentiation. They were all using the exact same weight, but it was only a 15-second video. So what right do I have to judge? But when I began to poke around and ask some questions, yeah, I was called stupid. I was told to shut up, all of these things. And I was triggered. I had reached out to Ash and a few others. Yeah, I just see that sometimes and I just get so upset.
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of horror stories that you could, routes that you could go down that would be quite demoralizing for kids to be. Now, there'd be some kids who would probably enjoy that kind of session enormously, you know. Yeah. But you're right. No differentiation, no student voice in that context. And I guess the regimentation and so on as well is... the stuff that we learn from history, having spent a fair amount of my career studying the history of physical education or histories and writing curriculum history, is that we see that whilst a lot of stuff changes, there's discontinuity between past and present. There's a fair amount of continuity as well, but often in a residual form. And one of the residues that we bring from the past, we have a past of regimentation. We have a militaristic past. We have a past of regimented exercising in unison, calisthenics and Swedish gymnastics and you know, all of these different things. And the teaching styles connected with that, which sometimes Mostyn called command or directive, they're still with us, you know. And there's only so much you can do with that kind of teaching style. I often say to my students, okay, I'm not going to do problem solving or whatever if I've got a class of 35-year-old non-swimmers. No guided discovery is going to be going on there. We're going to be pretty regimented about pool safety and so on. Okay, appropriate teaching style for the context in which we're working. But we can't apply that right across the board. And that is what we tend to do, one size fits all. And that's where some of the difficulties start, because there's just this long, long tradition. And then we don't reflect on that. We don't reflect on, because people don't know their history. So they don't know where these things have come from. So there's assumptions that, well, it's natural. This is right. This is how you teach physical education. And I'm the most important person in the room. I often say to students when I'm in a big lecture theater, which I hate, you know, you go in there, there's 200, 300 faces looking at you. And they're sitting in the rows as usual. And I'm on the stage typically. And the first session, I typically say, okay, what were the assumptions that the architects of this facility made about teaching and learning? And they're kind of looking around. First time anybody's ever asked them to think about something like this, you know? And I say, well, look, for a start, I'm the most important person here. So get that sorted right from the start. I know stuff, you don't know stuff. Information will flow from here to there. And we go on, you know, I go on. And you can see them starting to get really quite pissed off. You know, they start to shuffle in their seats and so on, look at each other, whisper, this guy's an idiot. What's he talking about? And then I say, right, we're not going to do any of that stuff. You're going to work in groups, even though you're in a very inconvenient sort of setup for this. And you're going to talk to each other. You're going to tell me stuff. We're going to subvert this architecture. But every university you go into, you will find that same kind of lecture theater. The same assumptions about what is effective teaching and learning. Yeah, that's what we need to blow up.
Yeah, I love that. And such a great way to kickstart a course is to get the kids to understand that it's not about that, even though the architecture is saying it's about that. So I love that. And I can imagine them in steep rows and having to turn around and, as you say, very uncomfortably interact, but at least, you know, doing that is such an important part of their learning. So as we segue into the end of the podcast, I just have a couple more questions. And the one question that I have for you is, what do you feel teachers and leaders in our field might need to let go of within themselves in order to make more of a difference? And I know we've touched upon some of those things, but in moving forward, what is your advice to teachers and leaders and what they might need to reconsider or let go of?
Yeah, it's almost, where do you start? You know, we've got this massive commercialization thing coming in. You know, the market has become important. I hear people talk about Fitnessgram a lot in this context, and the self-interest of some policy people and some researchers and teachers in what is effectively a commercial product being rolled out into school districts and so on. That's just one example. I don't know much about it. I've just read the bits that people like Michael Gard and so on have written, critical commentary. And they've been vilified, by the way, the same as those guys on Twitter were telling you were stupid. So that, there's one big impediment straight away, is that sort of self-protection, that the imperviousness to critique, unwillingness to stop seriously, reflect and listen to other voices. I read a piece today, just as chance would have it, that was saying that the universities in Britain are very, schools of education are very big on promoting critical reflection amongst their students, but they never ever do it on their own organizations. Okay, well, I think we've got a similar problem in physical education as a field. You know, generally, and this commercial thing is, in particular, I think has become problematic. I think sort of switching the focus somewhat, you know, what I said about, you know, for me, the shift away from understanding that it wasn't about me as the teacher, it was about the students and understanding much better where they were and where they were. I can see a lot of recognition amongst teachers that this is where they need to be. They must be more student, must be more pupil-centered in their teaching. But they don't necessarily have the training or the institutional structures that let them do that, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's the other thing that we might need to let go of. I think we need to let go of the secondary school status stuff that we've got. I mean, in places like Scotland, physical education is now a classroom-based subject with high-stakes national examinations. There's no physical, or there's very little physical activity in those programs. And that's all about status, as far as I can see.
Yeah.
But of course, it's natural. We've got people with kinesiology backgrounds coming into teaching. What do they teach? They teach what they know. Do kids need to know it? Well, I don't know. But so we've got that kind of stuff as well. Are we going to give that up, or are we going to at least accept that that's a different kind of thing from physical education that the majority of pupils could experience? Yeah, so I mean, that would be a starting point for me, Andy, you know, is some of the things that I think you talked about, a collaborative inquiry. I really, really like this idea. I think it's so important. The whole idea that we do work together with our different positionalities, bringing different things in to the mix. I do think that local is so, so important. That's another thing that I've learned over the years. You can make these global sort of statements, you can make these national policies and curricula, but it's the local that is the really, really crucial thing. And therefore, what we need to do is have a system that empowers the local, that puts resources where they're needed. And if that's forms of professional learning for teachers, if it's facilities and equipment, if it's hubs and collaborations and you facilitate those things. I know there's teachers here in this part of South Ayrshire, and it's a fairly rural community. You know, if I look out my window, I can see farms and hills and green and so on across the top of the roofs of the town. So they're quite spread out. There's quite big distances between the main settlements. And what they want to do is promote physical education in primary schools, and they want to use their secondary schools as hubs, and their teachers go into the primary schools that feed them. It's not a revolutionary new idea, but it's actually really important. Where's the resource to facilitate that? What do they need? Mm-hmm. You know, and who do they talk to about? So even something is crucial, you know, that's a good example, actually, of a local initiative, because they came to me, two of the teachers, one locally here, the guy, young guy, and another from a school further down the road. And we had a Zoom meeting, and they were saying, how do we do this? You know, And I could give them some benefit of things that I knew from the past that had been tried in different places, and what you might ask for, and how you could couch this, and what evidence might you bring to the party to persuade people. And, you know, so that for me is really, really important, is how you empower local action. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, again, I when I think of my school here, in particular, the context being in Saudi Arabia, a lot of the local kids are not very active, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's our number one goal is it's not about pushing them to be active. I go back to this idea of inspiring them, to find something that they love. And we've had so much success in getting Saudi girls on bicycles and then on skateboards. And it's beautiful. Brilliant. Seeing these local Saudi girls riding their skateboard to school with their hijab on and riding their bikes to school. And I wrote about it in the book, the chapter in the Meaningful PE book, this one story in particular of a Saudi girl who was pretty shaky on the bike at the start of the unit, started to explore hills, riding down hills, and then got more and more courage, rode down some steeper hills, realized her bike was old and rusted, and then convinced her Saudi dad, I need a new bike. So he bought her a brand new mountain bike, new helmet. She joined my after school club, which I wanted to align with the unit. And then she was off to the races and riding to school every day on the bike, going to the kind of desert area that we have hills and different types of terrain. And it was such a win, you know, and I was one of the beautiful stories of this approach does work. And then to begin to collect evidence of it working. So it's something I believe strongly in as well, the local. And just to end the show, David, can you, you know, given the pandemic and we're over a year into it, what's inspired you over the last year and kind of kept your fire lit? And you're obviously a lifelong learner, so it's not hard to keep your fire lit in that area. But what has inspired you over the last year?
I think staying connected with people is key. You know, I mean, okay, for all the inadequacies of Zoom that we hear about, and the fact that we can have conversation, and we're now doing this kind of thing. Well, I'm doing this kind of thing much more regularly. Yeah. I'm able to speak to colleagues in all parts of the world. I had a fantastic supervision meeting with a PhD student in Oslo yesterday, and you know, my wife says to me, "What part of the world are you talking to today?" You know. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And so I think that staying connected with people has been really, really crucial. I think it would be very, very easy to become quite isolated through what we've gone through. And at all sorts of different levels, professionally, personally, family, and so on. For me, it's not just about work, and it's not just being able to exercise has been crucial. We're blessed by having a wonderful national park, 5 minutes drive from here. We can walk in woods, we can walk by the sea, wonderful Isle of Arran across the water, and the Isles of Craig. Okay.
My buddy's been trying to get me to go. He gave me a bottle of Isle of Arran scotch.
They got a fantastic distillery there.
He plays the golf course there. I guess it's a 12-holer. So,
They've got several golf courses on the island, and you can get a package to go and play for a week, all of them.
Where you are. Yeah. Okay.
But this has been important. You know, you can even when you're told to stay at home, you can drive the 5 minutes to go walk the dog and get an hour's, you know, exercise. But I think also having other interests beyond work. So for me, it's music, making music, playing the guitar, the banjo, listening to music. I haven't got around to playing music with friends on Zoom yet, but I'm sure that's going to happen at some point. I think that all of those things have been crucial, and then just being honest about, because people have been up and down and up and down. It's just been honest about that too, you know.
Yeah.
People saying, "Look, I'm just not feeling great at the moment." It's you know, I always think of Ian Dury's reasons to be cheerful song. Come on, we've got reasons to be cheerful. We're still healthy. We're, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Appreciative. I heard a phrase from a guest, appreciative inquiry, that there's an approach now called inquiry. Yeah. Really interesting, especially bring that into the classroom. But David, where can people find your work? Is there a website or, you know, I don't think you're on Twitter or anything, but is there?
No, I'm Ash gives me a really hard time about this, and my other colleagues, that I don't do any social media. I have a website at the University of Strathclyde webpage.
Okay.
But you'll also find me at Google Scholar. If you put me in there, you'll find I've got a dedicated page in Google Scholar as well. So,
okay. Yep. Okay, great. So I'm going to put that in the show notes, and I really genuinely want to thank you for your time. That was a great conversation, and I really hope that we can connect again.
It was great, Andy. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm just going to close off the show, and then we'll just have a word. So everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Professor David Kirk, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.